Orr going through a shot.
Well, we had fun. We were a very close group.
Score! Phyllis Pizzuto has scored for the Bruins, his third of the night.
When you get to that room, that dressing room, is when you've got to become close. We were that way. We were unbelievably close.
Great save, Chambers! What a stop on Red Berenson!
We had a lot of fun, and that was one of our reasons for success, was that dressing room.
Derek Sanderson. Off the face, he scores!
If you wanted to fight, we could fight. If you wanted to hit, we could hit. If you wanted speed, we had speed. If you wanted finesse it, we had finesse. It was an unbelievable team.
Past the line, Westfall drive, scores!
I mean, the fans were just, they had been with us in, 13909, the building was full.
Johnny Busek gets the hat trick and grabs the puck as a souvenir.
You couldn't buy a ticket for the building, was always full. The fans loved us, we loved the fans, and it was all Bruins at that point.
Whoa, we own this town.
Did they ever? If you're old enough, you remember. If you aren't, ask your parents. Its popularity has had its peaks and valleys here over the years, but underneath it all, this has always been a hockey town. And the 1969-70 Boston Bruins took complete and total ownership of the city of Boston 50 years ago today.
Horry for the Bruins, tied up by Ecclestone and Berenson. Westfall rolled it in front. Sanderson tried a shot that was wide, and Keenan cleared it, but not out. Bobby Orr behind the net to Sanderson. To Orr! Bobby Orr scores, and the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup.
Come on in here, Harry. Harry, it's been a long season, but well worth it the way it finished.
Hey, listen, Don. It's Mother's Day, right?
Right.
And every player in this room thanks the day his mother ever bought him a pair of skates today, I'll tell you.
The most famous goal in hockey history was both a beginning and an end for Harry Sinden, the coach of that Bruins team that ended a 29-year championship drought. It marked the start of a three-year stretch of dominance that included two Stanley Cups. And it was the culmination of a decade-long climb from the ashes for a once-proud franchise.
What was it we used to say? We battled the Rangers for the East Coast Championship to see who was going to be fifth and who would be sixth. Yeah, it was only one way. It was up.
Eddie Westfall joined the club at age 21 at the start of the 1961 campaign. His first season would be the second of five straight years that the team finished in the cellar of the six-team NHL. Bruins legend Milt Schmidt had coached the team for most of the previous decade, but by 1967, he had enough.
It wasn't anything that I enjoyed, believe me. Of the four jobs that I had in the hockey, player and the captain of the Boston Bruins, and then I became a coach, and then assistant general manager, and then the manager. Coaching, in my opinion, was the worst job I had due to the fact that I had to worry about 18, 19 guys, whereas a player, while you worried about yourself.
He left the bench to take over as the assistant to general manager Hap Ems. Their next move would prove to be one of their best, hiring Sinden to replace Schmidt as head coach.
Well, I kind of went out of my element and used the phrase cautiously optimistic. They were pretty big words for me to use in those days, but that's how I felt. We had a press conference in the old Garden Club, and I didn't know a lot about the team. You know, we didn't get the TV coverage that we get today when I was out in Oklahoma at the time. I knew the players from training camp, but I hadn't really seen them play very much during the season. So I was not certain of myself as to what that type of team we were going to have, but I use the phrase cautiously optimistic.
Well, Harry played in Oklahoma City as a playing coach. You know, he was always ahead of the game, a hockey IQ, very high IQ.
Scotty Bowman was in his third year as coach of the expansion St. Louis Blues, and he was impressed with the new Bruins boss.
You know, they were a swashbuckling type of team, but they had tremendous faith in him. Harry was a very bright hockey man for a long time.
He knew when to blow the whistle, in other words, and say, okay, guys, come here. All right, let's keep focused here. He knew when to, you know, when to tell us to get back and get focused. So he had a wonderful feel for all of that.
One of the things I used to say to the players on occasion was, look, you guys are stuck with me for this year. And damn it, you're going to do what I want you to do or ask you to do. And if it's no good, there'll be someone else coming in here to tell you what to do. And I hope you do what they tell you what to do. But for now, I'm the guy telling you what to do, and hopefully we can do together, what will make us a good team? And I said that to the team many times, especially when it didn't look like we had a solution to our problems. We were in a losing streak or something like that. And they had to listen to me. And maybe they didn't want to, and maybe they shouldn't have had to. But the fact was they did have to. You do the best you can to bring the team together, and that's what I was trying to do. Fortunately, we had so many good players that it was a lot easier than some coaches.
One of those good players was Derek Sanderson, who earned the Calder Trophy as the league's top rookie in Sindon's second season behind the bench.
There is not a finer, smarter hockey man in a game in the history of the game. I mean, nothing he did not think of. And I never went into a game that Harry Sinden didn't give me something to think about. What he meant to the team is, well, everybody talks about Ken Dryden and what a great job he did in 1971 to beat us. No. The Bruins cost themselves because Harry Sinden wanted, I believe, $1,500 raise, and they wouldn't give it to him. And I said at the time, I said, you just cost the Stanley Cup. And that's how important he was.
He's a very smart guy, Harry. I said, he's one of my best friends still 50 years later.
Nate Greenberg would become a longtime confidant of Sinden after becoming the club's public relations director.
He had his own ideas. I could sit and listen to I would listen a lot of times. He and Tom Johnson talk about, what do you think about this guy? Why do you like his play? Why don't you like his play? He had an eye for hockey players. As a coach, I think he gave players leeway. He was much closer to their age than a lot of the other coaches they had had. I heard it once. I heard it 1,000 times in the last 40 years. You know, you ask Derek, you ask Bobby, you ask Phil. Phil will tell you. Harry was the best coach I ever played for. Understood their roles. Didn't let them get away with a lot, but knew where the line was, right? How much can you get away with? How much can you not? Without hesitation, I guarantee if you went around today, 50 years later, and asked them, who was their best coach? Who's the best coach you ever played for? Harry would come up in each one of them. And that's a heck of a legacy.
Shot is blocked. Sanderson a breakaway. Sandy's got it. Going in on Jockerman. Pulls him up. Scores! And it's another shorthanded goal for Derek Sanderson.
Over the line. Hodge closing. A shot. He scores! Ken Hodge.
Out to Stanfield. Goal! It's 1-0. The Bruins lead on a power play goal by Freddie Stanfield.
Rebound out front. Esposito.
Goal! It's 1-0 Boston.
I suppose it started to take shape just... Well, of course, you know, the fact that we started to get some much better players, and one of them was Orr, but even before he got there, we were starting to show signs of coming out of the ether. They got a couple more defensemen, the Smith brothers, and Donnie Orr, and then Owen Orr, and then, you know, and then, of course, the trade with Chicago. They got Stanfield and Esposito and Hodge. So, you know, the pieces started to come together.
The talent pool deepened around Westfall in the mid-60s. But it wasn't enough to prevent a 17-43-10 record during Sinden's first season in 1966-67.
I was so fortunate to even be back for my second year. I had a 2-year contract, and the first year was so disastrous. I thought it would only last the 1 year. I really did. And we were small. We had at Pitt Martin and Murray Oliver at center was not going to cut it in the NHL. But we were sitting with Orr, and I seemed to sense, as everybody else did, is if we could put a few pieces around Bobby and secure some kind of an identity as a team, which we did the second year, you know, with the addition of Teddy Green and Cashman and guys like that, we started to get named as, well, they call us the Big Bad Bruins, but we were a rugged, very, very rugged team, which the Bruins hadn't been for a few years. And we had really no identity, and by the time we got playing in the second year, we really had established one.
As the pieces were being assembled, the picture was becoming clear to a teenage Bruins fan and future Hall of Famer, the Boston Globe's Kevin Paul DuPont.
Well, it seemed like forever then, right? But now when you've got 50 years of watching this, is
been a fan in 40 plus years, it was very fast, and that's how great Orr was. I mean, no question, Orr was the galvanizing element in all of that. Yes, the great trade with Chicago and bringing Esposito here and becoming the most prolific center in the history of the game. But I have to say, it didn't seem long because it was so much fun, especially the fights. And of course, I'm being such a hypocrite now to talk about this, but I loved it.
Now, Jack Eagerson, don't go at it. Eagers and Doak flailing away in the Boston corner. And now McKay and Sanderson going at it right at the Boston line. And we've got a quick whistle as Magnuson hits Sanderson from behind. And Orr takes Magnuson down hard. Orr giving it to Magnuson. Right hand looping shots. Five, six of them.
There was all these sort of crazy elements. So you had the undertones of the fight, sometimes the overtones of the fights and the Donnybrooks. But there was a cultural explosion around this, too. We went from, you know, the era of the NHL when everybody in the league looked like they were 35 years old and they had the same brush-cut haircuts. And they were all, you know, to be honest here, they were all white guys from Canada, right? As a fan, even when they had their bad team, there were these little elements to watch. I'll give you an analogy with the Red Sox. When they stunk, there was still Raddatz to watch coming out of the bullpen, and there was still Yastrzemski. You'd stay, at least I'd get my dad to stay until you see Yaz's last at bat. And here you had Busick. He was especially with his hip checks, and he could put pucks away, so that was fun to watch. Cheevers came on a little bit earlier than the big explosion, so he was fun to watch. So there was always something, but were they in it? Were they going to win? No, they weren't. I mean, they were out of it before they dropped the puck in October, but it was still fun.
When we return, the kid comes of age.
But did I know I was going to make it? No. I mean, there were six teams, so many players. All I knew, I was doing something I loved to do. I had a great love for it. I had a great passion for it.
This is When Hockey Ruled the Hub, the story of the 1970 Stanley Cup champion Boston Bruins on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
I think the arrival of Orr and the presence he had, both on and off the ice, was no question, was the guiding light.
For Nate Greenberg and everyone else who followed the Bruins of the late 60s and early 70s, history is divided into two distinct eras, before Bobby Orr's arrival and after.
I just love being with my friends. Even, you know, when I was scouted by the Bruins, they weren't there scouting me. They were there scouting somebody else. They found me by mistake.
We went to watch two of our players, Eaton and Higgins were their names. Well, once the game started, we saw this little 12-year-old kid that looked like a 21-year-old kid, the way he moved the puck and the way he handled himself, and that was Bobby Orr.
Milt Schmidt was a Bruins legend as a player, but in the mid-60s, he was the team's assistant general manager.
There was five of us there that game. And we just went over and found out that he didn't belong to anybody. We put him on our list, and that's how we got him.
We were playing on a playoff against Gananoque. Even when Ren Blair started to hang around Perry Sound, Ren was going to be the general manager of Oshawa. And that's where they wanted me to go to play. You know, I was hockey great. I got to get a chance to play hockey. You know, I was understanding my dream was to play in the NHL, and I was understanding, you know, the steps. In those days, it was junior hockey. There wasn't a lot of college hockey, but I had no interest in college in those days. And it was junior hockey, and that was the direction. That was the way you would go in those days. So, you know, I was starting to say, geez, maybe I can realize my dream. But did I know I was going to make it? No. I mean, there were six teams, so many players. All I knew, I was doing something I loved to do. I had a great love for it. I had a great passion for it.
That passion would be put to the test as he started his way up the junior hockey ladder.
I can remember going to my first camp in Niagara Falls because the NHL teams own the junior teams, and they put all their players on those teams. and you sign what you call a C form. It was a contract that said that that team owned you, owned your rights until they traded or sold you or released you. But going to my first training camp, I can remember that because I went by train to Niagara Falls, and Niagara Falls was the other Bruins junior team in Ontario. And there were, you know, Bernie Perrant, Derek, Marat. There were a lot of big guys there, and I weighed 125 pounds, soaking wet. So they kind of laughed when I went in. They do a weigh-in, and you give your position, and you know, 125 or whatever it was. It was not heavy. Defense, and there was kind of chuckles throughout the room.
He was smaller and younger than everyone else, but wisely, nobody in the organization tried to change the way he played the game.
I was owned by the Bruins at 14, and if they were going to change me, they could have changed me in junior. I played 4 years in junior. I went from 14 to 18, and it was their farm team. And they did tell me to be careful, but I don't ever remember them saying to me, you know, we want to change you, and thank God for that, because I was that's the way I always played. That's the way I enjoyed playing. That's the way I was. I felt I was most effective. Certainly, my style didn't help my problems. You know, hockey's a tough game, and if you handle the puck a lot, you're going to be hit a lot. And I was. So obviously, my style didn't help my issues with my legs. But I would probably do it all over the same way. I mean, that was the way I enjoyed the game.
After averaging over a point and a half per game in three full seasons with the Oshawa Generals, Orr was ready for his first NHL training camp.
We trained in London, Ontario, and training camps were not like today where they're playing in 3 days. You know, that's not training camp. Well, we really went to training camp to get in shape and form lines and make cuts.
I remember sitting with Eddie Jay at a scrimmage. He's an 18-year-old. We just had one of them scrimmages at training camp, and we sit next to each other, and he had the puck for the whole scrimmage. And I said, this guy's going to be pretty good, you know. And he came with the reputation he had. He came with it, and that's all, you know, everyone, as soon as he stepped on the ice, you knew.
He made a great first impression on Bruins goalie Jerry Cheevers, while Ed Westfall had been tipped off on what to expect.
A little kid. My hockey stick was as big as him. No, I knew Robert Gordon when he played junior hockey in the town that I grew up in, on Oshawa. I mean, his MO, if you will, preceded him by quite a bit. I mean, he was an exceptional player, and everybody knew it.
Orr gets by Makita. Flips it across for Stanfield. Back to Orr. Shot. No! The Bruins take a 1-0 lead as Orr just walked in on Tonio and scored.
I coached a junior team. I coached the junior Canadians in it's got to be 64, 65, and he was such a heralded young player. He would probably have been about 16 at the time, or 16 or 17, before he got in the NHL. And the Bruins were struggling, obviously, in the early 60s, and they brought the Oshawa Generals. They had another farm team called Niagara Falls, and they had the junior Canadians, and Canadians were right at the top of the NHL at that time. And we went down to Boston, and we played them, and it was a showcase for Bobby Orr. They drew 8,000 or 10,000 people that watched a couple of games.
Future Hall of Famer Scotty Bowman was another early believer. But the guy whose opinion counted the most was Bruins head coach Harry Sinden.
Well, it was at training camp, and he was fantastic during all of our practices. We used to practice very, very hard in those days, twice a day. We had a training camp that lasted about 5 weeks. But the clincher was the first game we played. We played against Toronto, who had won the Stanley Cup the year before. And we played it at our training camp site in London, Ontario. Our training camp was ending after that game. And I was ready to jump in my car with Tom Johnson and drive to Boston when the game ended. And I left there saying to myself, not only is he good, he was the best player on the ice with the Stanley Cup champion team on the ice with him. He was easily the best player in the game. And I say that without reservation. He was only 18, playing against the best players in the world, and we didn't have the strongest team. I think we won the game 2-1, or we lost it 2-1, one or the other. It was close. And he was just outstanding.
Near the end of the camp in London, the general manager would start calling the players in to tell them where to go. And I got my call to go to the general manager's office, and he told me to go to Boston to finish training camp. We still had some time for training in Boston. So I had a car, and I get in the car, and I drove to Boston, checked in. Was it the Madison? Which was connected to the Garden. And we stayed at the Madison and finished camp, and I went in and opening night, and my number four sweater was there, and I played.
And when we opened the season that year, we opened again in Toronto, and he put on the same type of performance. I remember we were playing in Detroit the next day. It was a Saturday night in Toronto, Sunday in Detroit. And I was sitting in the lobby of the hotel in Detroit Sunday morning, and the broadcaster for the Toronto Maple Leafs came out to me and said, "That's a pretty good young player you got there. I think a couple of years in the minors, he might be able to stay on your team." I said, "You've been watching hockey for 40 years, and you say something like that?" You know, I mean, he was just magnificent, and most people couldn't believe what they were seeing when he first, those first few games he played.
Among them, Phil Esposito, who would benefit from playing with Orr like nobody else.
The first training camp in London, I watched him. Practices. I watched him in scrimmages, especially in scrimmages, because I just wanted to know exactly how he moved and where he moved and how he moved so that I can get into position that if he got in trouble, he'd get me the puck. So I was his sort of go-to guy. And I wanted that, obviously, because I wanted to shoot. And I just studied him so much. And I remember my ex-wife telling me the first time she saw us play in Oakland, California. She didn't know crap about hockey, and she said to me, "Boy, you and that number four have a lot of chemistry together." And I thought, wow, that's exactly what I wanted.
Orr has it at the Boston line. Out to Espo, walking in. Shot, goal!
Nobody ever had a defenseman that could skate as well. I mean, never mind a defenseman. I would say a player like Bobby Orr that skated, he had a motor that never stopped. Such a smooth skater. There's been a few in the league, but I still think he's a dynamic skater starting from he could accelerate in a second, you know, and don't forget, he could accelerate and carry the puck, which is a lot, been a lot of great skaters, but a lot of them didn't carry the puck like he did. I mean, he could go at full speed and knew what was around him. He changed the game. No question, he changed the defenseman rushing with the puck.
I sort of remember Doug Harvey, and Doug played, it was late in his career and early in mine, but he put some numbers up, and Doug had was a little offensive minded. And Eddie Shore was even offensive. They tell me that Eddie would go with it. Maybe not. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the offensive zone. I don't know if anybody spent as much time as I did in the offensive zone, but there were guys. I mean, Robinson put big numbers up. Potvin's put big numbers up. Raymond's put big numbers up. So there's a lot of defensemen who've put big numbers up. They're really offensive-minded. The Burns out in California. I really think if you look at the teams that win Stanley Cups, those guys that are creating from behind, I think that's a great asset.
And it was an asset Orr had in abundance, according to the Globe's Kevin Paul DuPont.
Eddie Shore rushed the puck. So certainly that was not a lot of things before my time, but that was. But yes, I mean, in terms of you knew he was going to be a fixture on the power play, but most importantly, that he was going to bring the puck up, and he was going to bring it up with great speed. And there was such a flair to it that he could get to speed so quickly and could play keep away. One of the great, great elements of Orr's game was on the penalty kill. He could just take the puck himself, and he would come up to mid-ice and retreat with it because he could just play keep away.
Hextall across the Boston line, off the boards, to the corner, it's Orr. Orr runs right into Saylor, knocks him down, gets the puck back. And here comes Bobby. Still stick handling, still controlling. Gets away from Hextall. On the move, Bobby Orr gets by Saylor, killing off the clock.
You don't see that in today's game. Everybody has great skaters in the lineup, so you might not be able to do that anyway, but people don't even think about that. The whole idea on the PK is to get it and throw it down the other end and make a change in 35 seconds and bring out new fresh legs. But I loved that part about his game, ragging the puck, bring it to neutral zone, take it back if he had to. It was just what he grew up doing, which was playing outdoor hockey. Up in Parry Sound, there were a lot of native North American kids, so they were out on the ice too, and it was just keep away. He brought that to his game.
It wasn't unprecedented to have a rushing defenseman. I mean, back to the time of Eddie Shore even, but nobody could do it with the creativity and the speed with which Orr did it. I mean, he was fearless, which is maybe the end one of his problems, because he kept dishing and going right through the middle and took some tough hits, and in a day when surgeries weren't as exact as they are now. But his ability to control the flow, to go end to end, to make the right pass at the right time, but always to be a visible competitor. I mean, no nights off, and the way he played it, it was dazzling.
Well, before he became a Bruins defenseman himself, Mike Milbury took notes from his home in Walpole. Bruce Cassidy did the same from his boyhood home in Ottawa.
He revolutionized the game, I thought, as a defenseman that carried the puck up the ice. When I started playing, they put me on defense for whatever reason, and I like to rush the puck too. You know, like every kid nowadays you watch, they like to skate with the puck. So, but he was able to do it and make it okay to do that, change the way maybe you looked at defensemen. They weren't just guys that were big that's, you know, kind of protected the front of their net and blocked shots. You need everything, but that's what I loved most about him. He's a dynamic player. And I thought he was very humble. When they talked to him, he always deflected praise and gave it to his teammates or whatever. And so I always kind of liked the way he went about his business as well. He was the best player, I thought, in the NHL. Yet, you know, it seemed like he felt himself as just one of the guys on the team doing his part.
Playing with Bobby Orr, who wasn't the type of guy that wanted to talk to the press. I mean, before I got my skates off, he was already in the damn medical room. You know, he showered and everything else. He was gone.
Esposito was more than happy to fill the notebooks of media members that Orr avoided, while Johnny Busick would show the teenager the ropes.
When Bobby first came to Boston, I was his roommate for a few years. He was such a shy kid, very, very shy, couldn't face the public. I remember going into restaurants and sitting there and getting ready to eat, and people would start staring. We'd just get up and leave, pay the bill and go back to the hotel and have room service. I spent a lot of extra money on food, but Bobby was a great competitor, just unbelievable, and he was a good kid.
I was quiet. I didn't say boo because I was nervous, frightened, whatever. I was lucky. All this stuff was written about this kid coming in and all this stuff, and they could have been really hard on me, and I was quiet, so I didn't cause any trouble, but they took great care of me.
A publicity-shy superstar could be a publicist's worst nightmare, but it was no problem for Greenberg.
He didn't like to speak to the media. He wanted the other players to get the recognition. So often, you know, he'd go in the trainer's room or something, you know, I'd say, any chance you could come out and speak to the guy? Well, he always did eventually, but he wanted the other guys to get the recognition. He was very cognizant of the fact that everybody wanted to talk to him, and he wanted them to talk to others. He sort of steps off to the corner in the hopes that the other guys will get the recognition. And I thought, you know, that's a special guy. There aren't many guys like that.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to talk to.
Up next, the great Chicago swindle.
We ended up getting traded that year to the Boston Bruins. It was the greatest thing that had ever happened to me.
When hockey ruled the hub, the story of the 1970 Boston Bruins returns right after this on 98.5 The Sports Hub. The 1969-70 Boston Bruins were largely a homegrown operation. Of the 28 players who wore the Spoke B that season, only 10 started their NHL careers in other organizations. Three of those 10 arrived in the summer of 1967 in one of the great sports swindles of all time.
Over the line, pass to Chico Mackey, too far. Bobby Hull gets a hold of him. There's another shot, they score! Esposito shot it into the net.
I was not a favorite of Jim Norris, who owned the team. He wanted me to be a rough, tough customer. Tommy Ivan, who was the general manager, I don't think I was a favorite of his either. And we ended up getting traded that year to the Boston Bruins. It was the greatest thing that had ever happened to me.
The Chicago Blackhawks sent Phil Esposito, along with winger Ken Hodge and center Fred Stanfield, to Boston for forward Pitt Martin, defenseman Jill Marant, and goaltender Jack Norris. Bob Verdi covered the Blackhawks for the Chicago Tribune.
I mean, Bobby Hull loved him. Chico Mackey loved him. But fans were on him a little bit, too, not just management. And he had the playoff in 66. They get knocked out. He gets one goal in six games. And then the next year, they finally finish first for the first time ever in franchise history. Think they're going to run the table. They get knocked out in the first round by an inferior Toronto team. Phil plays all six games, no goals, no assists, and now the Wolves are out. And I think that's when Tommy Iben and Billy Ray decided we got to shake things up. And he goes to Boston and becomes a Hall of Famer.
Well, my first year was only 27 games or 26 games because they made sure I went over 25 games, so I didn't have a chance to win the Rookie of the Year next year. Yeah, oh yeah, this is no because I had a bonus. And I played one shift a game, and I ended up with three goals or something and two assists in those 26 games and one shift a game. In fact, I remember a game in Toronto, and somebody from Toronto asked me if it was true. We were losing 5-2, 6-2. There was 2 or 3 minutes to go in the game, and Billy Ray, who was coach, says, Esposito, you go out there, and I hadn't had a shift all game. And I looked at him and I said, would you like me to tie it or win it?
There were also some positives for Espo in his four seasons with the Hawks. He learned the ropes from one of the game's greats.
Bobby Hull taught me more about life, about the game of hockey than anybody else in the professional ranks anyway. Anybody else ever taught me. For example, when I first got there, I was a kid who grew up in Canada where we used to do double negatives and say, oh, it don't matter. And Bobby, every time I said it, he'd say, Phil, it doesn't matter. And I remembered that forever. And this is Bobby, you know what I mean? And then we'd be on the plane, and it's the food on the plane is so bad, but I like the cheese. So Bobby and I would make trades. He says, okay, I'll give you my cheese and my crackers for that meal. I said, deal done.
So Esposito, the young rookie from Sault Ste. Marie, who has had a tremendous year with Chicago.
Yeah, there were signs that he had great talent. I think that because of his size and his disposition, you know, Phil, he likes to laugh and he's a loosey-goosey, which doesn't say he's not a great competitor. He was just, you know, one of the stories is that they thought he was a little heavy, you know, and wasn't focused. And one of his stories is that he, you know, Billy Ray would say, you know, you need to lose a couple pounds or whatever. So he would go into the sauna at the stadium, Chicago Stadium, and Moose Vasco would be in there because he's trying to lose a couple pounds. Except that Moose had like a 12-pack of beer in there with him. And Phil said, I would go into the sauna to lose weight, and I'd come out heavier than when I went in.
The Bruins were desperate to make a deal. Milt Schmidt was the assistant to general manager Hap Ems.
Hap and I, we went around to the various National Hockey League clubs and phone calls, and we weren't able to make a deal whatsoever. Hap Ems came to me one day and he says, Milt, he says, just forget about it. Nobody wants to make a deal with us and they just want our good players. And I says, well, what good players have we got that you wouldn't move? And he says, well, I'd have to give that some thought. But anyways, I said to Hap, I said, well, do you mind if I continue to try to make a deal? And he says, be my guest. So, which I did. I went to all the clubs, and eventually I got a phone call one afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was Chicago Blackhawks, Tommy Iben. So he asked for me. He says, let's make a deal. I said, Tommy, Hap Ems and I have been trying to make a deal with you for a month now and even longer, and we weren't successful. He says, let's talk about it. Gilles Marat, who we owned at that time, and a young defenseman, was the man that they really wanted. So after tossing a lot of names around, when I mentioned Kenny Hodge and Stanfield and Esposito, I named them, and then immediately Weston Adams was excited and very quietly he says, talk about that situation. Hodge wasn't playing regularly for the Chicago Blackhawks. He was sitting on the bench and then taking a turn here and there. Stanfield, he was up in the writer's room every time we went down there. And I had Freddie Stanfield as the instructor at my hockey school during the summer months, so I knew how he could skate, how he could handle a puck, and how he could shoot. And Esposito, yeah, needless to say, was the key man as far as we were concerned, because we knew that he could score goals and a great center ice man. So anyways, that started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At 8 o'clock at night is finally finalized.
The reaction was not all that alarming. It looked like a big trade and felt like a big trade. And, of course, you never knew that Hodge would become what he became, or Stanfield. I think the fans were kind of indifferent about Phil. You know, they thought that he could be better, and so did management. So, I want to say at the time, Gilles Marat was considered a pretty big deal, wasn't he? So, I mean, I vaguely remember even saying that, this was a pretty even trade. You know, this is, look what the Blackhawks got. They got this really young, rock-hard, tough defenseman, and Pitt Martin turned out, obviously, to be the best player in the Chicago end. But it was not perceived at the time, as, oh, my God, this is, what did they do? It's so lopsided.
The reaction was similar in Boston, according to Eddie Westfall.
Well, you know, it was a wait and see, you know, because we played against them when they were with Chicago. So not only the ability of the guys they got, but we improved our size, too.
Brown loses to Hodge. Puck is loose. Hodge out front. Casper, goal! The Bullets has a 1-0 lead. Hodge to Esposito. Goal!
It gave us a big line, and it gave us size. I mean, Hodge and Esposito were big men, both 6'3 or 4. You know, Hodge was about 225, and Phil was about 210 or something. Stanfield was, he wasn't big like they were, but he's a good-sized player and a centerman to boot, which was helpful. So we got two great centermen, and we got, actually, we got three players on the brink of breaking in as really established players in the league.
Esposito had played more of a setup role to Bobby Hull in Chicago. But Harry Sinden had different plans for him here.
I don't think he was used to playing that way. In Chicago, he played with Hull quite a bit, and Hull was a scorer on that team. But we were able to take advantage of what he had that most players didn't have in that position in front of there, and that was patience. He had great, great patience, and he could hang on to the puck with the defenseman draped all over him and wait till the goalie went down or moved one way or the other before he shot. And his shot wasn't anything to write home about, but usually he had such a big part of the net to shoot it in, he didn't need to be. No, that was something he developed himself. And he saw with Orr, that was the place to be. As the sign used to say, you know, Jesus saves, but Esposito scores.
Well, when I got to Boston, Harry took me aside. I was in London, a training camp, and he says, I want you to be the scorer, the shooter. And I said, what do you mean? He said, hash marks around there. And slot area, the hash marks. He said, I'm going to get you two guys that can get you the puck, and I want you to be that guy. So you're also the high man. I said to myself, sure, there's paid guys that score. Let's do it.
He stayed in there, and he was strong. He was a good size. He's strong upper body, and he had a very terrific shot. I mean, I coached against the Bruins later on in that decade, and I mean, I'm telling you how good he was. He was such a great finisher. He could be between defensemen, still moving his stick around, and he just had a knack of finding openings. Like, he didn't score goals from 50, 30, 40, 50 feet. They were all, like, right around the crease, rebounds.
Scotty Bowman had his hands full over the next decade and a half trying to devise ways to prevent those goals. Easier said than done, according to the Globe's Kevin Paul DuPont.
Ultimately, it comes down to ability and size. So he was certainly not the biggest, but he was very good size. But it comes down to touch and sense. So much of goal scoring is, at the time, and goal scoring has changed dramatically over the years in a number of different aspects. But what Espo did was, beyond his size and his reach, which those were the physical elements of the game, is having that spatial awareness of where to be. It's one thing to have that ability, wingspan, but you've got to, if you're 12 inches closer to the goalie, then you're negating it. If you're 12 inches back from your, if you will, the sweet spot, then it doesn't become as critical or doesn't become as effective. have. But Phil had that, I don't know if anybody's ever had that sense of where to be, where the rebound's going to be. It's also knowing who the goalie is, what the goalie's tendencies are, if he's catching with his left hand or his right hand. So there's more science to it than I think a lot of people think. I think more than anything, he just had a very particular art form in front and a body that could hold it. We forget, too, that was the era when you could take a cross check across the back to the point of the guy, the defenseman could virtually crack that stick across. That was okay. That's the way it was.
The cross checks I could handle, it hurt. Don't get me wrong, because we had no padding back there. But it was when they held my stick, and right in front of the referee, or held my arms. Carl Brewer used to cut the palm of his glove out, so that he could get, and the glove would be over top of the stick, but his hand would be on the stick closed, so he couldn't move it. And I used to go, I remember Bill Friday, I'd say, "Don't you see what this son of a bitch is doing? Come on, Bill. He's holding on to me. He holds my stick all the time. Come on." And I remember one game in particular, I wasn't playing very well, and I started complaining about a guy holding my stick, and he looked at me and he says, "Why don't you just admit, Phil, you're tonight."
The defenseman had to have an active stick. He wouldn't be able to move him physically much because he was good on his skates, you know. And so you had to have a guy that could poke the stick. The guy had to have a strong stick. You had to tie the stick up. You couldn't tie the body up, so you had to tie the stick up if you could. But, he was an awesome scorer. You give him five chances and four will go in.
You know, when you're able to bring players like that in, and Phil in particular, and put him alongside Orr, this was great for Orr and it was great for Phil, and they fed off each other for many years.
He was a big guy, and he kind of, if you look at some of the video, he kind of was out a little deeper than, don't forget, right now they put 4 feet in the offensive zone, extra feet, that's a lot. So back then it was much smaller in there, and he stood in a spot, and he could really shoot. He had a heavy, heavy shot. And, you know, Cash is in the corner working. And he was kind of in a funny spot out there. They couldn't get out to him. And he could shoot it. I mean, he had a real heavy, heavy shot. But he was a great goal scorer. And, again, when they start talking about great goal scorers, you know, they don't often talk about Phillip, and they should.
The combination of Bobby Orr and Esposito gave the Bruins an offensive attack, especially on the power play, that was just unstoppable.
Back to Orr. Orr, line, turns the net. He comes hard, center ice. Coming up over the Toronto line. Now left to Stanfield. Now to Esposito in front. Scores! Phil Esposito, power play goal as he gets his 23rd.
Our power play was so good, I don't even think they kept track of it. Like percentages, all that other stuff. Our power play was just that freaking good. It was devastating, and yes, I played the full 2 minutes of it mostly, and I think Bobby did too.
The power play that came out of it sometimes was Hodge would play on the right wing, other times it'd be McKenzie, but with Busick mainly on the left wing and Orr and Stanfield on the point, was probably the best power play in the league at that particular time. You know, the power play was just developing as a playmaking group, the way they played it. Montreal had some great power plays, but no one else really had a power play that moved the puck around other than Montreal, the way I thought the Bruins did in those days.
Don't forget, Pye, Chief and I played on the power play, the first power play. Catherine Hodgie didn't, with Bobby and Freddie on the points. That was the first power play unit, and it just worked absolutely perfectly. Johnny Pye was a little bit of a crazy guy. You know, he'd go in and he'd cause trouble and what have you, but Chief was a calming influence on that left wing and was always available if you needed to get a pass to him. And once he got the puck, he would look for me in the slot right away on the power play. And I'd shoot.
Espo was just as dangerous with his even-strength running mates Ken Hodge and Wayne Cashman.
Hodge, pass across to Cashman. To Phil Esposito. He's tied up by Jarrett. Hit the side of the net. Esposito, circles, shoots, scores!
Out front, it's loose.
Rolls it to Esposito. Quick shot. Save. Cashman gets it. Shoots. Save. Cashman shoots. Scores!
Cash was a corner man. And one funny story about Wayne in Buffalo one time. He went in a corner with Schoenfeld. and they were fighting for the puck, and I'm in my spot at the hash marks, Hodges at the corner of the net, just in front of the goalie, where he's supposed to be. I said to myself, I better go in and help him. As I go in and help him, he gets the puck, puts it in the slot, and Gilbert Perreault was making a circle, full blast, picks up the puck, goes all the way down, and scores on Cheesy, right? We come off to the bench, and Cashman says to me, I looked at him and I says, I'm sorry, Wayne, he was red. His face was like a tomato. I thought he was going to blow up. I said, I'm sorry, Wayne. I know, Cash. I should have been there. He looked at me, the exact words to me, he says, if you ever come in my corner again, I'll kill you. You understand? I'll kill you. I said, no problem, Wayne.
His persona was interesting. I mean, this was a guy, I mean, there was just something about him. If you were around him, he was the focus. When he was in a room, he was the guy that everybody was gravitating to, even if Orr was in the room, because Bobby was more, you know, laid back. But Esposito just attracted people.
Tom Larson, the longtime studio host for Bruins broadcasts on Channel 38, remembers the big center with the even bigger personality. So does B's PR man, Nate Greenberg.
You know, well, there's no question. He loved to talk, Phil. He still does. Gregarious, outgoing, terrific teammate. Tough not to like Phil. It would do anything for you. What you see is what you got. Fun-loving. There's no question that, obviously, Orr was in a class by himself, but Phil was right there.
Up next on When Hockey Ruled the Hub, they had more than just Orr and Esposito.
Gaspin trying to work his way in. Does. Quick away. Go!
Penny Hart deflecting in. Phil Esposito, center and pass.
Let's call the rebound. Score!
That's next on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
Greer's putting the ball on a play. He gets it out deep, and Havlicek steals it over the stand zone. Havlicek stole the ball.
The pitch is looped towards shortstop. Petroselli's back. He's got it. The Red Sox win. And it's pandemonium on the field.
At that particular time, they were probably third. The Celtics are on their run. And the Red Sox, it's always a Red Sox town. But it's also a Bruin town.
Jerry Cheevers would know. While the Celtics were collecting championship banners and the Red Sox were dreaming impossible dreams, the Bruins were packing 13,909 fannies in the seats of the old Boston Garden on a nightly basis, despite spending the first half of the 60s in the NHL cellar.
I would say at that time, and maybe one other time to present, it was down. It was down. But the Bruin fans are terrific, smart. They were just waiting for it to come back. And when Bobby and company came, and they knew right away, then you couldn't get a seat.
The results took time, though. They finished last in Bobby Orr's rookie season in 1967. In 68, they had a winning record for the first time in a decade, but promptly got swept by the Canadiens in the first round of the playoffs. Then in 1969, Orr and company won their first playoff series in 10 years, sweeping Toronto to set up another postseason matchup with Montreal.
From the Forum in Montreal, Hockey Night in Canada presents the opening game of the Stanley Cup semifinals for the Eastern Division. Tonight, the Boston Bruins, after downing Toronto four straight in the quarterfinals, meet the Canadiens. Montreal took New York 4-0. Their quarterfinal series, and now the two top clubs meet in game number one tonight.
Well, during the season, our team, we could see it was starting to come together. The guys, the pieces were there, you know, from goaltending to, you know, we had the solid guys like Ori on defense and Dallas, and the pieces were coming together, and we felt it. But, you know, I've learned that you have to be ready to win. You have to be ready to. We weren't quite ready.
Off the boards, Provo stopping it at the point. Provo working in for Montreal over to Béliveau. He shoots, it scores! Béliveau! And the Montreal Canadiens have won it on Jean Béliveau's goal. And Jean Béliveau, believe it or not, has never scored a goal in sudden death overtime until this very moment.
It was a great experience, that playoff for us. And then the next year, we were ready.
After pushing the eventual Cup champs to six games in the spring of 1969, the outlook for the following season was bright, but that all changed in an instant during an otherwise meaningless exhibition game in Ottawa.
We made reference earlier to the criminal charges against the NHL players. This is an action believed to be unprecedented in NHL history. Two players face criminal charges for brawling on the ice. Charged with assault, causing bodily harm, are Ted Green, a defenseman with the Boston Bruins. He suffered a fractured skull, and his playing future is, as a result, uncertain. And Wayne Mackey, who was with the St. Louis Blues, but now plays for the Buffalo Bisons of the American Hockey League.
Well, obviously, Teddy had a great reputation. He wasn't only a real good hockey player defensively, but he also was a tough guy and well-respected.
The popular defenseman would be lost for the season, leaving general manager Milt Schmidt in full scramble mode.
When you lose a guy like that, the opposition knows now that they can take other liberties, which they never did with Teddy Green on defense. So it was just a little bit more difficult trying to make the opposition realize that they're still going to get hit, regardless whether Teddy was there or not.
You know, he was a good player besides how rugged he was. He was not easily replaced at all, and he was a favorite of his teammates. But, you know, a kid like Ricky Smith came in and did, despite lacking some of the skills, skating skills, et cetera, he was a really valuable player for us. Dallas Smith really stepped up. So we had players in the system that came along and did very well.
All the way around to Stanfield. Centering pass, shot! Oh! Stanfield keeps it in the zone. Busick gets it back. Wheels in the corner. Shot by Stanfield, he scores! It's 2-0.
Intercepted by Busick. To McKenzie. Back to Busick. To McKenzie. Stanfield, shot! Up front, goal! The Bruins lead it 2-1. Johnny Busick for the Bruins on some great passing between Busick, Stanfield, and McKenzie.
They were billed as Harry Sinden's second line, but their numbers were first class. The combination of Johnny McKenzie, John Busick, and Fred Stanfield ranked third, fourth, and fifth in scoring on the team, with a combined 83 goals and 197 points, anchored by the team's de facto captain.
Into Esposito, shot saved. Busick scores, it's all tied up. And Busick continues to be red hot in this Stanley Cup final for the Chiefs. His 10th playoff goal of the year.
Oh, he was, are you kidding? He was a terrific player. You know, he had the big rear end. He could make a hip check like nobody's business. He was a great scorer. He was a terrific player. I mean, there was never any doubt that he had Hall of Fame written all over him, right? I mean, he was not underrated. People who played with him and a lot of the fans, they knew what kind of a player he was, you know. He was a unique guy, a terrific player, and a terrific teammate.
Nate Greenberg remembers the Chiefs' prowess around the net, and Phil Esposito had a simple explanation for it.
Chief was just that guy. I remember my brother saying to me one time after the game in Chicago, he said, "What the f*** is that ass of Chiefs? That's the biggest ass I've ever seen in my life, and he gets in front of me. I can't see f*** but his ass."
As good as Busick was on the ice, Orr will never forget his contributions off of it.
Chief was the captain, and Chief was the man. Chief was my first roommate. Johnny Busick was my first roommate. And I remember it was like yesterday. They gave me a key. I checked into the motel. They gave me a key. I opened up the door, and there's Chief laying on the bed, smoking a cigar. He smoked cigars in those days. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Busick. You call me John or Chief?"
Kasman trying to work his way in. Does. Breakaway. Goal! Put it up in Boston. A good deep by Kasman, and he walked in on Daly and scored.
Phil Esposito, the shot! Penny Hart deflecting in. Phil Esposito, center and pass.
Hodge and I, from the moment in Boston, we played together the whole time. And then Wayne, who was younger than us, he came up, I think, 3 years later or 4 years later, and it just worked.
They were more than just Phil Esposito's escorts. Kenny Hodge and Wayne Cashman presented a big obstacle to Bruins opponents. Just ask then St. Louis Blues coach Scotty Bowman.
Hodge, Cashman, and Esposito, big guys. You know, Hodge and Cashman and Esposito, when you look at the size of those guys at that time, you know, Cashman was tough as nails. Cashman didn't back up from anybody, and of course Hodge was a monster strong. These are all pretty big guys, you know.
Kenny Hodge was what we call a short range scorer. His goals were from 5-8 feet in front of the net, so he picked up a lot of stuff there that didn't go in, and you need somebody like that. Cash brought a sense of fear to that line as well. He was as rugged as they come, And he was a good player, too. Great in the corners, and there wasn't anybody going to take advantage of Phil while Cash was on his line. So it turned out to be a line with great size, probably the biggest line in the league of the day.
Big in size and in production, Espo, Hodge, and Cashman combined for 77 goals and 188 points that season. So with a top six that wore out red lights all over the NHL, it fell to the Bruins' third line to keep the opposition off the scoreboard.
Here comes Bobby Hull, broken up by Westfall.
I was playing defense with Leo Boyven, and then they put me up on the front line because I like to skate and I take faceoffs. And Forby Kennedy and I were killing penalties, and then I'd go back and play on defense some of the time. And then as we got, as I say, better defensemen, I went up front and stayed up there.
Eddie Westfall anchored the Bruins' third line from his right wing position, where he had already become one of the NHL's best penalty killers. But his pairing with Derek Sanderson formed a unit that was dangerous offensively as well.
Kicked ahead for Sanderson. Sandy going in. Shot. Goal! Two shot-handled goals on one penalty. The Bruins are breaking this game wide open.
Yeah, no, he and I, we got teamed up pretty early on. I remember his first game was in Toronto, and we're sitting in the very front seat of the bus where the steps come up, and so he's bouncing around like Billy Martin on steroids. Anyway, so we get talking, and he's all excited about playing his first NHL game, and I think Milt was the coach, and he said, "Do you think Coach Smith will mind if I get a few penalties?" And I said, "Derek, the coach may not, but I may. They better be damn good ones, because I have to kill them."
Which they did, because they didn't mind doing the dirty work.
We had a pretty good sense of the game, and the fact that we never ever, Derek and I, even to this day, will laugh and say, well, the one thing about our statistics is that we never got any power play goals. But we got more shorthanded goals than a lot of power plays.
While Westfall was a veteran on the PK, Sanderson entered the NHL as a scorer. He rang up more than 2 points a game in his final year in junior at Niagara Falls. But he found himself third on the Bruins' depth chart at center, and it led to a tough conversation with Sinden about his role on the team.
He pulled me aside. I was a left point in the power play my rookie year. And Harry said, well, I'm going to talk to you. I don't think you're going to be happy about this. I thought about it all summer. He said, I want you to take penalty killing to an art form. You and Eddie will be out there every time. I said, well, I want the money. I won't get the points. I'm going to get the game down. We'll know. Your teammates will know, and I'll know.
We had a system, and we worked on it and worked on it, and we killed as much of the penalty as we could in the offensive zone. But we had this setup that we would try to keep the power play down in their end as long as we could. And it worked pretty good because they weren't used to having guys so aggressive as penalty killers. And, of course, we both took face-offs either side, depending on who was the opposition, left or right-handed. And so that worked for us, too. And, of course, as I always said when they said about penalty killing, I said it was easy. Derek or I'd win the face-off, give the puck to Orr, and then we'd get out of his way. We'd lean on the boards. He'd skate around for 2 minutes, and they'd all chase him.
In all, Westfall would tally 18 shorthanded goals in his 11 seasons with Boston, while Sinden watched Sanderson retire with 34, a league record at the time.
Sanderson, had I not put him on a line like that, he probably would have scored as many goals as anybody else on the team. He was a great goal scorer and a great offensive player. But, you know, I asked him to do a role, and he did it.
His face-off percentage was astronomical some years. I mean, he was a student. I mean, he knew he needs to study. You know, it's before they had video and all this stuff. He used to watch just by eye, watch guys, learn how to take a face-off.
My dad made me do that when I was a kid, when I was young, playing bantam, 11, 12 years old. He had me pay attention to every face-off. You're a centerman. If you win them all, back to your defenseman, who then turns back a little bit, passes to his partner, you're going to have the puck, my father used to tell me, a good 7-8 minutes more than the other team. And that's a good thing.
Derek was a terrific hockey player. His talents weren't underestimated by his teammates, but I think they were by a lot of, especially the fans. You know, he had the hair, he had the whole look, mustache. Character. He was one of the characters. The game didn't have a lot of characters. He was a unique individual.
So was the guy who did the bulk of the work between the pipes during that 1970 playoff run.
Here's Lemaire. He's got Redmond.
He's open to Redmond. A shot. Great save by Cheever.
Here's Bob Plager holding it in. Hooked in the shot. Oh, Cheever's a great save on Bob Plager and then held on to the rebound. Oh, what a goaltending move by Jerry Cheever.
Cheever's whole thing was he wanted to win. You know, if they won 10-8, he didn't care. He wasn't interested in the stats, didn't care about his goals against average. Did we win? That was what it was all about. And he loved to have fun. He was still, and does to this day, but he was a terrific, underrated goaltender who wasn't adverse to giving, taking a stick to somebody if they wanted to. I mean, it was a different kind of a game back then, a different time. But I never think I've ever had a guy that I worked with that I said, wasn't it, didn't care what his goals against was, save percentage, none of that stuff. All he wanted to do was win.
My dad was a Hall of Fame lacrosse player, box lacrosse player. And I don't know, that's just the way I am. I mean, I'm still the same way playing golf with my kids. I don't let them beat me. It's just that, I don't know, I loved winning. You know, when you like winning and care about winning, and that's what you're supposed to do, win, you put more into it, I guess. I don't know, really.
He excelled at keeping the puck out of his own net, but Scotty Bowman was just as impressed at another aspect of his game.
Jerry Cheevers was a great skater. In fact, he went to a school in Toronto. He's from St. Catharines, Ontario. And he went to a school, St. Michael's. It was a very big hockey, like it would be regarded like a, wasn't a prep school at that time, it was a high school. And a lot of great players come out of St. Michael's, Mihovlić and Tim Horton, Dave Keon, just a continuous amount of players. And he went there, and when he went there, I'm not mistaken, you could even ask him, sometimes they played him as a winger. They had a couple of goalies. He could skate. He was the best skating goalie in the league for sure. Not many in the history of the league could skate like Jerry Cheevers with that equipment on.
Nobody really handled the puck like Jerry. I remember once we were playing in St. Louis and he came around the net and went to pass it up to one of our forwards and he put it right on their stick and he was out of the net and they scored. And it was a big goal. It was either the go-ahead goal in the second period or tied the game or something. And the players dropped their heads and everything. We got in the locker room. I said, oh, so you're mad at Cheevers, right? He handled the puck 10,000 times already this year, and it's the first time he did that. You know, I wish I could say the same for you guys.
Well, in junior, a year, we won the Memorial Cup. I played 12 games of forward. I played under a guy named Father Bauer, who was a very creative guy, and he promised some other guy a shot at goal. So he put me up at forward for 12 games. I had some 2-3 assist games, and I could carry the puck and handle it, and I could skate. And I had confidence to handle it, too. So I did handle it, and it didn't bother me. I don't think I ever got much trouble. My first thought of, as soon as I got it, was to give it to Bobby or other defensemen that could get it out of there. It never bothered me. I did it with confidence.
Jerry was fantastic. He would help out our defense and our forwards so much to get out of trouble in our end. And he knew what he was doing with it. He had a tactic in those days. He was allowed to do a little more than they are today. He could freeze the puck just when we wanted it frozen in our end. He was really good, and very, very few people competed the way Jerry did. He was the ultimate competitor. His goal, I thought, in hockey was not to have the best statistics, but to win hockey games, and that's what he really worried about. It could be winning 6-1, and they make it 6-5, but they'd never make it 6-6.
Here comes Canadien, Grenier.
Look away, a shot. 1.3 to 3-2.
That has to be the save of the year.
When we return, the stakes get higher, and so does the temperature.
Puck loose in the corner. Sanderson double-teamed, and here we go.
He and his buddies yelled at me, you make one move and you're a dead man.
The playoffs are next. This is When Hockey Ruled the Hub on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
Six seconds to go, and the countdown begins. 1 second, and it's all over. The Bruins have won it 3-1. They've won the big ones when they've had to.
The race for the NHL's East Division title would be decided on the season's final night. The Bruins and the Blackhawks were tied in points with 97 each. Boston took care of business with that 3-1 win over Toronto. But they would need a Chicago loss or tie to take the title, since the Hawks held the tiebreaker based on more wins. The Bees game started an hour earlier than Chicago's, so they crowded around a radio after their win to learn their fate.
On the face-off, Gauthier, and it's a
Pat Martin did his former team no favors, scoring a hat trick in the Blackhawks' blowout over the Canadiens. Bob Verdi of the Chicago Tribune.
They go from last to first, which was unprecedented at the time, and won it on the last night of the year with that crazy game in Chicago where Montreal pulled the goalie with the midway in the third period because they needed goals. It was 5-2, and Claude Ruel pulls Vachon because they need five goals to make the playoffs to catch the Rangers, and ends up 10-2.
So the Hawks took the tiebreaker over the Bruins, and with it, the division title. The Rangers edged out Montreal for fourth place by virtue of more goals scored, setting up a Boston-New York first-round matchup.
We've lost track of that. We still think of Canadiens being their number one rival. And, of course, they went from 1943 to 1988 without beating Canadiens in the playoffs. So it is a great rivalry. But at that time, the rivalry with Rangers was really something.
That's the Globe's Kevin Paul DuPont. And the numbers back him up. While the Bruins finished 7 points ahead of the Rangers in the East Division standings, they won only two more games, and they were separated by 0.05 of a point in 5-on-5 goal differential. Two evenly matched teams with one major difference, according to Ed Westfall.
Were they ever a good team? Huh? Yes, yes. They had Brad Park, and they had Rattel, and they had Gilbert, and they had, oh no, they had a, yeah, they had a great team, but they didn't have war.
Brown loses to Hodge. Puck is loose. Hodge out front. Yes, the Bullets go 1-0 win. Espo right out front. Blocked by Jackman. Good save. Espo. Goal. And beat Giacomo through a screen. It's 3-1 Boston. Orr going through a shot. Oh! And Bobby Orr has scored a shorthanded goal for the Bruins. Kicked ahead for Sanderson. Danny going in. Shot. Oh! Two shorthanded goals on one penalty. The Bruins are breaking this game wide open. Loose puck out front. Esposito scores. It's 6-1 Boston. And for Espoo, the hat trick. 8 seconds left. The countdown begins. Shot by Irvin, blocked by Dallas Smith, and cleared the length of the ice. 2-1, and it's all over. The Bruins have won the opening game of the quarterfinal round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. The final score, the Bruins 8, the Rangers 2.
A night later, in Game 2, the real Rangers showed up.
Puck loose in the corner. Again back to Horton. Fires again, and it goes in. It's a goal as Jack Egers, I believe, tipped it by Cheevers, and it's all tied up. Egers with a puck. 2-on-1. Gilbert blocked by Dallas Smith. Goal! And the Rangers take the lead for the first time in this series. It's 2-1 New York.
That was the score after 20 minutes. The Bruins gave the Garden faithful what they came to see over the next 40.
All the way around to Stanfield. Centering pass. Shot! Goal! And McKenzie has tied it up. A blistering bullet that Sawchuk still hasn't seen. McKenzie out to Stanfield. Busek on the left wing. Moving through. Shot. Goal!
Marco stopped by Hodge. Going in on Sawchuk. Shot. Goal! It's 4-2 Boston. Orr checked by Tkachuk. Gets away from Tkachuk, and he's got the puck. Using Ballone as a screen into Westfall. Cutting through. Goal!
The final was 5-3, and the Bruins took a 2-0 lead to Madison Square Garden for games 3 and 4. The bad blood had started to boil, especially between Derek Sanderson and New York goaltender Ed Jockeman, as Westfall remembers.
No, they've been mouthing off at each other. You know, and back then, you know, there was a lot of byplay, verbally, physically. And Derek and he had made a few statements in the paper and this and that. And during games, they'd be jawing at each other. And of course, Eddie Jockeman was a really very strong competitor, as of course Derek was. So you just knew that at some point it was going to happen, and it did.
Shot by Marcotte. Goes behind the New York net as Brad on Marcotte. Puck loose in the corner. Sanderson double teamed, and here we go. Everyone on the ice piles on.
Sanderson is on the bottom as the Rangers have ganged up on Derek Sanderson.
I think it was right from the beginning of the faceoff, right at the start of the game. We went down into the end and Jockerman charged at him. I said, okay, here's two guys, neither one of them know how to fight, but let's step back and watch. It'll be fun.
Marcotte's trying to tear him apart. Sanderson still throwing from both sides. Marcotte's got a hold of Tkachuk. Now Tkachuk has him backed up against the board. Sanderson still flailing away. Tkachuk was on one side, and I believe it was Brad Park on the other side. They just ganged up on them and started hitting them one from either side.
Bruins coach Harry Sinden.
Sideline to that story was President Trump was sitting there in the stands. The two benches in New York were side by side. And Trump and his buddies, he was about college age or maybe 23, 24. He told me this story himself. Emile Francis and I started yelling at each other between the benches as if we might try something too. And Trump was there. And he heard us, and he and his buddies yelled at me, "You make one move and you're a dead man."
Sinden survived, but after 80 minutes in penalties, 90 seconds into the game, the Bruins now knew they were in for a battle.
Kept in by Rattel. Gilbert fires, kicked out, goal! Rebound shot by Rattel, and it's all tied up. Tkachuk across the line. Fires, goal, and New York takes the 2-1 lead. Here's Rattel out front, across, shot, goal. Gilbert has put Rangers ahead 3-1. Behind the Boston net, Irvin out front, shot save, another shot, and it goes in, it's 4-1 New York. On the faceoff, cross to Orr in the slot, shot blocked at the buzzer, and it's all over. The Rangers have beaten the Bruins 4-3.
The blue shirts showed they wouldn't be intimidated. And they'd carry that momentum into Game 4 24 hours later.
Now it's Rattel. In tight. Shot. Go. Gilbert scores again. It's 2-0 New York. Pass goes behind. Here comes Ballone in on Johnston. Shot. Go. And the Rangers come right back. Ballone to Tkachuk. Shot and a goal.
4-2 was the final count. And the series was tied, heading back to Boston for Game 5.
Orr across the line. Going in. Shot. Go. And the Bruins played it 1-0. Westfall. Now Park across to Eager. Shot, goal, it's all tied up. Lead pass to Kurtenbach. Going in on Cheevers. Shot, goal, and it's 2-1 New York. Cashman taken to the boards by Gilbert. Across to Esposito. A shot, goal, it's all tied up.
Orr has it at the Boston line. Out to Espo, walking in. Shot, goal.
Off the faceoff. Bruins win the draw, and it's all over. They've won it 3-2.
Game 6 was back at MSG two nights later. And the New Yorkers struck first.
Kept in by Park. Fakes the shot. Gets around Sanderson. Into the circle. Gilbert blocked out front. Goal! And New York has taken a 1-0 lead.
It was 1-0 Rangers after the first period. But then the Bruins put their foot to the floor and ended New York's season.
Dumps it inside the Boston end, right on the stick of Bobby Orr. Orr straight up the middle. Breaks. Drop pass. Busick. Across to McKenzie. Shot. Goal. Well tied up. Cashman off the back of the net, and Horton picks it up. Cashman shot at the post. Goal. It's 2-1 Bruins. Is Hodge to Orr. He fires. Goal. It's 3-1 Boston.
Westfall in the New York corner. Out to Sanderson. Goal. It's 4-1 Boston. And Sandy threaded the needle with that shot. And it just bombed by Jackerman into the far corner. And the Bruins have taken a 4-1 lead. 6 seconds, five, the countdown, four, three, saved by Cheevers, two. It's all over, and the Bruins go to the finals against Chicago. The final score, it's the Bruins 4 and the Rangers 1.
They were probably pretty equal to us except for Orr. They had Park, but he wasn't Orr. I think their team matched up really well against us. And I'm not sure, but I'm glad we had Orr and not them.
Bobby, what do you expect from Chicago?
They have a great team. They got the goaltending. They got the scores. I watched the Detroit series a couple games on TV, and Makita's playing better, and I've seen him play all year. And that big guy, Bobby Hull, is skating like heck, and it's going to be a tough series, but I think we got a lot of horses.
One of the biggest challenges for Bobby Orr and the Bruins in the East Final, shutting down Chicago's Golden Jet, Bobby Hull.
Harry, Barry thought that it was very important that you don't let Hull do what he does best, because he can blow a game wide open. How do you think I got my nickname, the Shadow? You know, that was what he assigned me to do, and I loved to skate, and so that was, I said, if he went to the bathroom, I was going with him. Yeah, I remember him sometime later after the season or a year or something anyway, because I knew him. We grew up in the same area. He paid me one of the best compliments. I mean, he really did. He was such a classy guy, Hull. But he said, Ed Westfall, he does it the proper way. He skates with me. He covers me. He doesn't let me do what I want to do. Or if I get the puck, he's on me right away. I have to unload it. And he said he was the most effective cover I ever had. And I thought that was pretty nice for a guy that could easily get pissed off and then throw me out into, you know, three blocks down the street.
With Westfall clamped onto Chicago's big gun, it was the former Blackhawk who made the difference in Game 1.
On to Phil Esposito. Esposito, one man back in with Busek. The shot, he scores! Phil Esposito beats young brother Tony on the short side. It hits the post and then bounced in, and the Bruins lead 1-0. Here's Orr at the blue line. Holding it in, that's Phil Esposito. He says he scores! Phil Esposito beats younger brother Tony on a low shot, and the Bruins lead 2-0.
From the faceoff, back to Orr, the drive! Esposito to save! Esposito scores!
Phil Esposito got the rebound on Bobby Orr's shot, with Tony Esposito at stop, and Phil Esposito flipped it in for the hat trick.
Espo led the way in the 6-3 win, as Boston stole home ice advantage away from the regular season champs. Then they'd make it two straight in Chicago two nights later.
Orr gets by Makita. Flips it across for Stanfield. Back to Orr. Shot. No! The Bruins take a 1-0 lead as Orr just walked in on Tony Orr and scores. Stanfield keeps it in the zone. Busek gets it back. Wheels in the corner. Shot by Stanfield. He scores! It's 2-0 Bruins. Good pass to Phil Esposito. Ahead to Marcotte. Marcotte shot. Glove save. Esposito. Lays it for Magnuson. Marcotte stays right with him. Shot! Goal! Marcotte scores for Boston. It's 3-0. Dennisall in the Chicago corner. Hit the side of the net. Esposito. Circles. Shoots. Scores! It's 4-1 as Phil Esposito has scored his 10th goal of the series.
Tapping across to Bobby Hull. 3 seconds. And it's all over. The Bruins have won 2 in a row here in Chicago.
2-0, that's, I don't know what to say. We're in a better position now than when we came in here. We got the goaltending. Our defense played well, but our forwards were a big help there. I mean, they're shooting the puck in, they're going in after, but there's always one man coming back, so I don't think they had a 3-on-2 all night long. And the goals came from everywhere. Every line scored a goal. I got a great defensive game from Derek Sanderson's line, and great penalty killing from that line. Eddie Westfall was on Bobby Hull all night. There was one star tonight, and that's the Boston Bruins.
Orr and company returned to the Garden for Game 3, but the Hawks took a 2-1 lead in the first. The Bruins' power play, which had scored at an unheard-of 29% clip during the regular season, came up big once again in the second.
McKenzie in the corner, right across the point. Goal! Johnny Busek scores for Boston. It's all tied up. Bobby Orr legs it back up through center ice. Cuts deep. Goes behind the net to Esposito. Shot! Goal!
Kept in by Bill White, 8 seconds, stopped by Chivas, cleared by Orr, and Orr controls as the time runs out. It's all over. The Bruins have won the third consecutive game over Chicago. The final score, the Bruins 5, Chicago 2.
Johnny Busek's 2 power play goals put the Bees 1 win away from the cup final. They'd outscored Chicago 15-6 in the first 3 games. But the Blackhawks wouldn't go down without a fight in Game 4.
Orr couldn't get away from Coral. Orr has it again. Shooting it out at center, and Esposito gets it, has a break on the left wing. The shot! And the save! Marcotte! He scores! Don Marcotte! The Bruin rookie! Stanfield at center, a long shot. McKenzie racing in after it. Centered it, and Busek the shot! Esposito shot! Rebound! He scores! Coral centered and right across the goal mouth. Magnuson, the drive, he scores! Keith Magnuson. Makita into the corner for Coral. Cliff Coral across the goal mouth to Dennis Hall. He scores! Dennis Hall set up beautifully. Orr still with the puck. check from behind, and back comes Dennis Hull with Chico Mackey trailing. Dennis Hull on the right wing. Goes in on goal. He shoots. He scores! Dennis Hull!
Tried to clear it out. Does. Stanfield racing after it. Gets the puck. One man back. Stanfield is shot. Stanfield! A booming slap shot that just caught the inside of the post.
The game was tied at 3 through 40 minutes.
Now Dennis Hull out to Magnuson. Magnuson the drive. Cheever's the save. And the rebound. To Campbell. He scores. Brian Campbell got the rebound.
Cashman in across that line. Working it in front. Turned around into the corner to Phil Esposito. A shot.
Kenny Hodge deflecting in. Phil Esposito center and pass.
Now Moan. Checked by Busick. Was centered into Makita. Cleared it but not out. McKenzie. Passes to Stanfield, to McKenzie, shooting, he scores!
John McKenzie, firing it into the top left-hand corner, and the Bruins go ahead 5-4, and the whole Boston bench empties to congratulate McKenzie.
Puck has dropped, Makita, there's a shot by Westfall, and stop, the game is over.
There's Phil Esposito going right over to congratulate brother Tony as the game ends, and now the Bruins raced out onto the ice to congratulate their goaltender, Jerry Cheevers, and each other.
Johnny McKenzie scored the deciding goal, and he got the last word as his team headed to the Stanley Cup Final.
John, did you see the goal? Any choice? St. Louis, Pittsburgh.
We don't care who we play. I think, if we could get the Net and Palominas up in Alberta, we'd sooner have them.
Coming up next, it'll take more than 60 minutes to claim the cup.
And the siren sounds, and regulation time has ended.
More of When Hockey Ruled the Hub, the story of the 1970 Stanley Cup champion Boston Bruins, right after this on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
We had a lot of confidence. That team had a lot of confidence. I can't recall them ever getting ready for a game without feeling they could win it. Any game, any team. They were really sure of themselves. Played that way. I mean, I don't think it was being brass or anything like that. It was just how strong they were.
Harry Sinden's club was on a roll, and the whole city jumped on the bandwagon.
It was all Bruins at that point. You know, we were an exciting team to watch. You couldn't buy a ticket for the building. It was always full. The fans loved us. We loved the fans, and it was like we were always together with them. Don't matter where we went. We went to a restaurant, and you'd run into a lot of people. You'd sit there and talk to them, and we were all very sociable. So it was just a great experience in the early 70s. It was pretty wild.
Johnny Busick had seen the highs and lows of playing in Boston, having spent 12 seasons with the Bruins before that 1970 campaign. And he was the glue that held that team together, according to Nate Greenberg.
Absolutely. That's what he said. He was like a big brother to it. And Busick was the guy who was, he was great to those guys. Took them under his wing, and you need this, place to stay, whatever it is. He was the guy that did it.
Yeah, we were very tight. On the road, we always went out after a game together. Even the night before the game, we went together. At home, after a game, we all went together. Everybody showed up all the time. The harmony was there, and that was so important, especially in those days.
We were good friends. All of us were good friends off the ice. When you get to that room, that dressing room, is when you've got to become close. We were that way. We were unbelievably close. If anything happened in that dressing room or on the ice, we were all in it together. And I think that had a lot to do with the way we were. We were a good hockey team.
Phil Esposito gives an example of just how close that early 70s team was.
I got hit in 1973 in first game in Boston, 2 out of 3 we played against the Rangers. Came over the blue line and I went to cut and my skate gave away and Ronnie Harris, who was always hitting low, got me on the knee, the right knee. And I mean, I heard the pop. My wife told me she heard it in the stands, the big pop. Ended up, that was it. And I'm in the hospital with a cast on from my groin to my tippy toes, because that's what they did. I had a medial collateral and anterior cruciate. Both of them were gone. And the door opens, and Bobby comes into my room, and he said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine." He said, "Listen, we're having a party tonight, the wrap-up party at Branding Iron." You know, he owned the Branding Iron. And he said, "We're coming to get you for the party."
That is true. We thought it was funny then.
I'm embarrassed by it today. Someone suggested we go get Phil, and by later in the day, it was a great idea. Early in the day, it was so-so idea.
I said, I can't go to any freaking party. I got a cast on my leg. How? And he says, don't worry about it. We'll come and get you tonight sometime. Well, about 7:30 at night, the door comes open, and there comes Bobby with a hospital gown on, the mask, the hat, with four or five other guys.
Over we go, and the hospital wasn't as busy as it is now, and there were elevator operators, and it was different. So we fixed Phil up with the weights on it because he was in traction. And we wheeled his bed out the door onto the elevator.
The elevator was directly across the room door from me. So they wheel my bed into the elevator, give the elevator guy some money, I don't know how much, and brought me down there with a hospital Johnny on and a sheet and my leg in traction sticking up. And I'm thinking, what the, guys, I'm yelling, Bobby, you can't do this. What's going to happen here? He said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We get to the door at the basement of the Mass General. It's those electric doors, you know, when you step on, they open up. There's a bar in between. They actually ripped this freaking bar right out of the cement. And now they got the bed out.
And we pushed the bed down Blossom Street and carried the bed into the bar and got Phil some cheese and crackers.
They broke the wheel, so they had to carry me up. They put bricks underneath the wheel that broke and this stinky provolone cheese in between my legs and a beer in each hand. And he said, let's go. Let's party.
And it was really funny to watch the people that were there. They weren't sure that they were really seeing Phil Esposito in a bed in the bar.
I had a couple of beers with them and a laugh, and the music was playing. And then I look up on the television screen, and the bottom of the screen comes across Phil Esposito kidnapped from Mass General.
And I got a call from the doctor. He said, you have my patient? I said, yeah. I said, yes, sir. He says, get him back.
It was a fully functioning Esposito that would take the ice for the start of the Stanley Cup Final on May 3rd, 1970. Their opponent would be the St. Louis Blues, the winner of the expansion West Division. They'd finished a full 13 points behind Boston in the regular season standings, and while they were playing in their third consecutive Cup Final, they had yet to win a game there. They were swept in four straight by Montreal in each of the previous 2 years. If there was ever a chance for Eddie Westfall and company to be overconfident, this was it.
Harry was on top of us, you know. He didn't have to say much. Harry, you could tell just when he said some little words and he gave you a look. Yeah, there were two guys that knew how to stare you down if they didn't think you were playing up to snuff, Orr and Sinden.
Scotty Bowman coached that St. Louis team.
We couldn't handle the offense of Boston. In fact, in one of the games in St. Louis, to just give you a reference to how good the player he was, or a greater player he was, Bobby Orr, I mean, he could run the game. I had one of our players, a good defensive winger, Jim Roberts, I had him shadowing a defenseman. We did a good job, but we couldn't handle the other guys. They had too many weapons.
Scotty Bowman was their coach, and he put in a system whereby he took one of his players, Jimmy Roberts, as I remember, and kind of glued him to Orr. And even if the puck was in the St. Louis end and Orr didn't go down with the team, Jimmy Roberts would stay in our end with Orr, and he wouldn't leave him. And so Busick was wide open on his goals, and it turned out that the way Bobby played it helped us, even though he himself was kind of stymied.
Back to Rick Smith, the drive, Wakely stopped it. Busick got the rebound and scored! Johnny Busick gets the hat trick and grabs the puck as a souvenir, a Stanley Cup final hat trick for Johnny Busick, number 9.
And it was a good system, and it could have upset a team that, you know, didn't have the confidence we had. Like, those players would look at a system like that. They would kind of laugh to each other about it. We'll beat that. Watch what we do. You know, but it did have a good effect, and it was a good idea by Scotty to try. That was the only time, that was the first game, and I think he tried it the second game, too. That was the only time that I had any concern about that particular series.
2 seconds left. Boudreaux shoots it back in. The buzzer goes to end the game, and the Boston Bruins lead the best of seven series 1-0.
Busick's hat trick led the way in the Bruins' 6-1 romp. Game 2 would be more of the same.
Bobby Orr starts out slowly, cuts right in front of Jerry Cheevers, feeds Esposito at center ice, trying to go around Bob Plager in front, blocked by Wakely, out to Stanfield, goal! It's
1-0, the Bruins lead on a power play goal by Freddie Stanfield.
Here's Rick Smith with Westfall. His shot stopped by Wakely. Westfall, a rebound, scores! It's 2-0, Boston. Bobby gets by two of the Blues, three of them, out through center ice. Full steam ahead, past the line. Westfall drives, scores!
6-2 was the final count as the teams headed to Boston with the Bees up 2-0. The only question at that point was whether they'd need a return trip to St. Louis.
Stanfield into Esposito. Shot saved. Busek scores. It's all tied up. And Busek continues to be red hot in this Stanley Cup final for the Chiefs. His 10th playoff goal of the year.
McKenzie. Shot. Goal. And it's 2-1 Boston.
Esposito center ice. Dumped by Jimmy Roberts. Here's Cashman. Shot. Goal. It's 3-1.
Rolls it to Esposito. Quick shot. Save. Cashman gets it. Shoots. Save. Cashman shoots. Scores! Wayne Cashman, who with Esposito and Hodge, they had about a half a dozen scoring bids. And Wayne makes it 4-1 for Boston.
Puck rolls in the center ice, and Dallas Smith has it. Dallas over to Gary Doak. Doak to Hodge. Fires in. Bounces wide of Hall. The game is over, and the Bruins win it.
The final score here at Boston Garden is Boston 4 and St. Louis 1. We'll return in just a minute.
It was really a fait accompli. I mean, they had won the first three games against St. Louis, but in terms of the excitement, it was more delivering what you knew what was going to happen. They weren't going to lose to St. Louis.
Bedford's own Kevin Paul DuPont would spend most of his adult life covering the Bruins for the Boston Globe. But on this date, he was just another smitten fan, hunkering down to listen to Fred Cusick and Johnny Pearson call Game 4 on Sunday afternoon, May 10th.
Mother's Day, 1970, and I was in the second floor of our house in 15 Fitchdale Avenue in Bedford, taping every second of it on an Ampex tape recorder that I just bought from Sears. And I have to say, I think it was around 100 and a half, which was a lot of money back then. And I bought the Sears Best, and I still have them, the Sears Best cassette tapes, and I taped every minute of that, every second of that game.
The whole city was ready for a celebration. And so, as it turns out, was Derek Sanderson.
I wore a tuxedo that night. St. Louis, they're not going to beat us. So I wore a tuxedo to the Garden, and the guy said, "Oh, what are you doing?" Teddy Green said to me, "What are you going to do if we lose this?" I said, "I never thought of that."
Dallas Smith goes to the corner, checked by McCrary at the backboards. Still forces it. Sanderson rolls it back. Rick Smith moving. Fires. Scores! Ricky Smith from Derek Sanderson. And what a play Sanderson made on that one with a sweep check that got the puck back to Rick. And he fired from 25 feet to beat Hall.
Over the line for Berenson. Berenson sweeping in. Now sends Bob Plager in for a shot. Save. Score, Berenson.
Red Berenson put the rebound in from Bob Plager to tie it up at 1-1 with 43 seconds left in the period.
St. Marseille starts out. Right wing center ice coming hard, bothered by Carlton. Over the line, he's checked. Puck loose. Sabourin gets it. Fires. Scores! Gary Sabourin from Frank St. Marseille makes it 2-1 St. Louis.
Puck down. Hodge battling for it. Esposito gets it. Shoots! Scores!
Ties the game up at 2-2.
Plays it back to Roberts. Right point. Shot wide of Cheevers. Rebound. Goyette right in front. Backhander by Keenan. Scores! And Keenan puts St. Louis in front. 3-2.
We did pretty well in game four. The game that Bobby Orr scored this famous goal, we were ahead. We had a 3-2 lead with maybe half the way in the third period. And don't forget, they're coming home to win the cup. Yeah, we battled, but we couldn't handle the offense.
His pass stopped by McKenzie. Back to Rick Smith. Rick up to McKenzie. McKenzie in front. Tip score! Busek! John Busek tipped it home from John McKenzie and Rick Smith.
3 seconds left. The backhander bounces wide of Glenn Hall. And the siren sounds, and regulation time has ended. The score at the end of the regulation time here at Boston Garden is Boston 3 and St. Louis 3.
While the outcome of the series wasn't really in doubt, Game 4 was still a toss-up after 60 minutes.
Harry Sinden had a decision to make to start the extra session.
I always felt that overtime would be settled in the first 5 minutes. And so normally Esposito's line should have started so we could get a goal. But being up 3-0 in the series, I wanted to make sure they didn't get one in the first 5 minutes. And so I started Sanderson and Westfall, who were really two top-checking players.
Phil might have been a little upset, but Harry came to me, and between the, at the end of the game, Harry said, listen, usually these things end pretty quickly, and the only chance they got if it ends quickly. So let's get them by a couple of minutes. Let's get them out. Remember, in those days, we used to play a minute and a half, no shift. So get us past the opening, and they can double you back and make it a defensive battle, and then eventually you're going to, you're going to win because we're just was that much better.
You know, as somebody I said to Harry years and years and years and years later, I said, did anybody from the media, from the press, television, radio, anyway, did anybody ever ask you why you started Swoop Carlton, Derek Sanderson, and Eddie Westfall up front at the start of the overtime? He said, no, no one ever asked me. I said, wouldn't that have been a very good question by a reporter or a television person? As to, okay, with all the firepower you got with Freddie Stanfield's line and Phil Esposito's line, why did you start Sanderson? I'll tell you what his answer was to me, because you guys were the best line I had.
When you have flexible players like that and talented players like on that team, a lot of things fall in line that may not otherwise in another year with another team.
For St. Louis, it will be Berenson at center, Keenan left wing, Egglestone right wing, Picard and Talbot are the defense with Glenn Hall in goal. All set for overtime. Here's Fred Cusick.
Okay, it's sudden death overtime. Sanderson and Berenson on the faceoff. It's underway and Talbot has it at the St. Louis line. Over to Noel Picard now. Up in the center ice to Egglestone. Now back to Talbot, trying to move it out. Talbot. Pass up, stopped by Orr. Center ice to Sanderson quickly. Sanderson flips it in off Egglestone. Down on the corner goes Carlton now. Behind the net, trying to control out in front. It's loose. Cleared away. Goes back to Donari. Left point. He fires a rolling puck. It's blocked. Sanderson gets it. Fires and misses. Blocking it was Talbot. Puck kept in by Boston. Westfall rolls it to Sanderson. A shot. It's blocked in front. Orr fights to keep it in. Does. Has it in the corner to Sanderson. Back in front to Orr. Shot. Scores! Bobby Orr from Sanderson! And what could be better than that? As they beat St. Louis 4-3. Orr to Sanderson, back to Orr, and they go wild. And Orr fell down in the corner, and they have surrounded them. What a scene, John.
After 40 seconds of play, Bobby Orr. And I tell you, if I had to pick one person on that ice to get the goal, it had to go to Bobby Orr. A fabulous season. A fabulous playoff, and he and Sanderson return passes from the right corner, behind the net to Sanderson, out again to Orr, cutting in close, and he fired a short shot behind Glenn Hall, and the Stanley Cup belongs to the Boston Bruins for the first time in 29 years.
Puck into the offensive zone, and it came up my boards on my shot left, but I was playing the right side, and the puck came up, and I kept it in. I got lucky. If it hadn't hit me, they were gone for 2-on-1.
Well, I got to tell you, I disagree with Bobby, and the film will bear me out, because I watched him go in off the point. I had a good view, and I saw Westfall come over and take his spot, which most of the players that played with Bobby on the forward line were aware of what he might do once he got the puck on the point and were prepared to come back and cover up for him, particularly Westfall or Sanderson or Marcotte. Those type players. You know, I saw him go in. I saw Westfall come across the ice and cover up for him.
Orr headed for the net. And, of course, my job was, whenever he was on the ice, because he was up the ice half the time, was to cover his position on defense. So I just swung quickly over to the point position as he headed for the front of the net, and Derek passed it to him, and bang, it was in.
I was pumped. I saw it hit the net, back of the net. I said, hey, well, that's it, I think. And I never really reacted right away. I don't know, it's kind of like in the NFL, you're waiting for a penalty flag, right? Is everything okay? And it was.
What a play. St. Louis was clearing the puck up the boards. Orr plays the right point. He took a little gamble, not for Bobby Orr. And he kept it in, and that changed things. St. Louis thought they might be moving it out. And he got the puck up in the corner. And there was Sanderson alone off to the left of Glenn Hall, and he passed to him and cut right in front.
and Sanderson returned it, and it was in the net.
John G. Talbot should never have come to me. When he came to me at the poke check meeting, he flipped it over, and then the rest was up to Bobby. Yeah, I mean, that puck had a line flat, but he never held it. He just redirected it, really.
I put it back in the corner to Derek, and then I went to the front of the net, and he gave me a pass. As I move across the front of the net with the puck, Glenn Hall, the goalie, he has to move, and when he moves, his legs open. Now, I'd like to tell you that I saw his legs open. I turned the puck up on its edge, and I put it in that hole. But really, I was just trying to get it on net. And as Glenn had to move across, his legs did open, but I didn't see them open. I just tried to get it on net, and it went between his legs.
Bobby Orr had a Cinderella year. He was, I mean, not that it was a fluke, but he had did everything right. Got into another planet. For him to get that goal, that's what I was happy about, is that he did everything for everybody, and he finally, and it came to him. I said, it's great. This is great. I'm glad he didn't miss the pass, but that's good. Because there's nobody behind him but St. Louis Blues player.
All season long, one of the big advantages Orr has had is that great anticipation. And I'll tell you, he made the play there because a normal defenseman wouldn't have been in the position Orr was in. But he stole the puck as St. Louis were coming out, and he fired that perfect pass to Sanderson, standing just a little bit to the side of the net, but behind it against the boards. And the return pass as Orr came in, and he fired it by Glenn Hall. Magnificent play by Sanderson and Orr. And the Stanley Cup is in Boston.
Eddie Westfall, come on up here.
I tell you, it's been a long, long time coming for me. And what a hell of a hockey team. And we're having a hell of a time now.
Johnny Bisick, it's been a long time waiting.
I've been waiting for 15 years for this, and this is the year. And I don't know, I don't think I'll be able to sleep for 4 days.
Westfall, come on over here.
I'm so happy, Don. I'm telling you right now, I'm going to go crazy tonight. Right out of my mind.
Two wars. Bobby and his dad, Doug. Congratulations, Bobby, on a tremendous victory.
Thanks, Don. It's so great. I don't want to say this team, unbelievable. The guys that are hurt, they're out yelling for us. Between periods, they're in the stands, they're fighting for us. The guys that are playing, goaltending, we put everything together. Just a great bunch of guys. Great.
Doug, how do you feel about it?
This is the happiest day of my life. This is the happiest day of my life.
Come on in here, Harry. Harry, it's been a long season, but well worth it the way it finished.
Hey, listen, Don. It's Mother's Day, right?
Right.
And every player in this room thanks the day his mother ever bought him a pair of skates today, I'll tell you.
I mean, the city was just, it was bonkers. And they were bonkers for the Bruins. When I walked in August, and, you know, they were a month away from the first game. And as I say, I was really confused as a basketball guy from the Midwest. You know, what's wrong with these people?
Tom Larson became a familiar face to viewers of Bruins hockey on Channel 38 that season.
The city was just taken over. It was outlandish. I'd never seen anything like it. And I don't know if there has been anything quite like it. And I've been in Boston 50 years now. I'm familiar with what's been going on with the Patriots. I don't believe the intensity was... it hasn't been matched in the 50 years that I've been here.
Everybody was watching. Your teachers in high school talked about it. All your pals in high school talked about it. It was just so central to everything. It's so easy today in terms of watching highlights, and you can watch every NHL game. This was really a special event that just dominated all conversation at work, and they were really big people around town. They were rock stars in this town. They owned it. It
meant a ton to the city. This was not the glory days, 1970, not the glory days that we've seen the last 20 years here. You know, they were few and far between. The Red Sox hadn't won anything. The Celtics had won. They were the one team. Patriots weren't even around. There was a hockey core in Boston. Still is, I think. It's not quite the same. But to see the Bruins win in 70 and how it took over the town and City Hall and the parade and all, it did a lot. It captured the city unlike anything I said at the time I had ever seen.
I told John Henry, the owner of the Red Sox, when he first bought the team, you know, this team goes wild over a winning team. I said to him, you'll see how much the Bruins mean to this team, even though baseball is the established sport in the country. And, you know, that day or two, or really more than that, long time after that, brought out the joy of Boston fans for having a team like the 1970 Bruins. And they themselves were, you know, they were more of a swashbuckling team than any team I think we've ever had. I think the Red Sox had a team, it was in 2004. couldn't keep up with this team, I don't think. And the city of Boston, that's the way their people are. They loved it. It was just fantastic. The gatherings and the players were just so excited. It was great. It's never been forgotten. You know, we've won a couple of championships since, both fantastic. 2011 was great. But it seemed to be, for some reason, 1970 was just a little special.
Keenan cleared a but not out. Bobby Orr behind the net to Sanderson. Orr! Bobby Orr! Scores in the Boston Bruins! Have won the Stanley Cup! We own this town.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.